Are counsel ready to proceed?
I am, Your Honor.
The next matter on calendar is Dunn v. State. It is case number 62676. Ms. Forsman, you filed a reply brief, so you may reserve time for rebuttal. How much would you like?
I have reserved 5 minutes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Fannie Forsman appearing on behalf of Patrick Dunn, the appellant in this matter. The prosecution theory in this case was that Patrick Dunn and or his friends or somebody in the area of Patrick Dunn's vehicle instigated the fight with the Especias, and that when the shot was fired that killed Eric Especia, the fight was over. To quote the prosecutor in the closing, he said, he had trouble on his mind, referring to Patrick Dunn, and that trouble did not originate with the Especias. The issue that developed, I think, in this case, and it developed too early, it developed prematurely, and the defense was cut off prematurely by the motion in limine filed by the prosecutor, in which the prosecutor apparently knew that there were violent acts on the part of the Especia brothers or others in the Especia group, and sought to preclude the reference to any of those specific acts using the Dorian Daniel case and NRS 38.055. And I think the problem developed in this case because everyone, I think it was really everyone, thought that Daniel and 48.055 occupies the field whenever specific instances of conduct are sought to be adduced with regard to the victim in a self-defense case. And that's simply not so. Can you imagine a trial court or this court even saying that it is okay to preclude a prosecutor from adducing evidence, if he had it, which he didn't, that Pat Dunn had on numerous previous occasions or several previous occasions gotten intoxicated in this parking corridor in Elko at the cantina or the tiki hut and had started fights and had gotten into brawls both before and after the incident? Can you imagine any trial court saying you can't bring that in to show what happened on that night, to show who was the initial aggressor? But the problem came up, and as I did the reading for the preparation of these briefs, it's clear that this is not an uncommon problem, because the minute that the word propensity is used, our minds go to character. We say, well, it must be character evidence. But the fact of the matter is that 404B in the federal system and 48.0452 in our system is propensity evidence, but it's not based upon a character theory. The way that the determination should be made, and I referenced this article in my briefs, in Winkelried, known to all of us for his evidentiary articles and scholarship, describes the way that you analyze this issue as to whether or not the other acts are being offered for character or being offered for something else. And he says that that it will pass muster, the specific instances of conduct will pass muster, i.e., will be admissible, if the inferential path from the item of evidence, which is the bad acts, which is the getting drunk and beating people up, and a fact of consequence in the case, which is who started the fight and whether or not Eric Especia was coming toward Pat Dunn when he fired the shot, does not require, as long as it does not require any inferences as to the defendant's personal subjective character. In other words, if we are not saying that you must decide whether or not Eric Especia was coming at Patrick Dunn, by the way, he had just bashed his head into the ground when this occurred, that you cannot decide that based upon a determination of whether or not Eric Especia was a bad person, was someone worthy of being punished. But if you can say that the prior acts show circumstances, show why it is likely that Eric Especia and Sal Especia were the instigators of this altercation, And I can't think of anything that would show that more clearly than the fact that they had been engaged in this kind of conduct on several occasions previously, and on several, and Salaspecies, with regard to Salaspecies, afterwards, in the same area, the same kind of conduct, the same drunken kind of brawling.
Now, factually, again, if you could clear this up for me, it seems like there was an altercation. It stopped. There was a period of time that lapsed when Mr. Dunn had gone to his car to get the gun.
There was no stop. In fact, the evidence is quite clear that it had not stopped, because what had occurred, now, of course, you've got, and this is the reason I charted out all the witnesses, because, if you're going to have inconsistencies, and probably even if everybody had been sober, you would have inconsistencies as what they heard. But the witnesses that the prosecutor's relying on, so let's make the inferences in favor of the prosecution, say that it had not stopped. Their witnesses, Esther and Specia, and then they say that the centerpiece was, I've forgotten the name.
I know.
Angela Evans, okay, who's in the car. That's the centerpiece of their testimony. And she says that Brandon, her husband, didn't get his neck broken, okay, until after the shot. So clearly the fight had not occurred. Salaspecies talks about holding Chance Creamer up against the car when the shot is fired, threatening to kill him, and saying, I would kill you, but I am trying to stop the fights, which, by the way, is something that certainly implicates whether or not he actually is a fight stopper or a fight starter.
So this is more of a defense of others as opposed to self-defense.
I think that's not correct, Your Honor, because the fact of the matter is that Pat Dunn, when he talked to the police right afterwards, says he was coming at me. Okay. He also, I'm not excluding the defense of others, because clearly it was going on all around them. You had a fellow on the ground with a broken neck who had to be airlifted to Salt Lake City, that Salaspecies had broken his neck, that ended up with people, there were about 30 people who were punching and beating Brandon Evans.
And this is after the shooting, after Mr. Dunn had left.
Correct.
And left his friends there.
But the prosecutor's theory is that the fighting stopped, but there really is nothing to support that. The jury was entitled to hear, in analyzing this testimony, the jury was entitled to hear that it's likely that Erica Specia was coming toward Pat Dunn in the circumstances of this case because of his previous incidents of starting fights and brawling.
But so you have initial aggressor, which would allow your client to raise self-defense.
Correct.
And by virtue of the motion that was granted here in favor of the state, that information was kept from the jury.
The specific instances of conduct, these specific instances, whether or not they were cage fighters or whether or not they'd gotten in fights in other areas of town, really what the guts of this argument has to do with the specific instances of conduct, which the trial attorney, trial counsel said, this is their métier, which is their MO, which is 404B language, which is what these brothers did, and the jury was entitled to know that. They got the weakest kind of evidence. As a trial attorney, when I try cases, I rarely put on reputation evidence because it means nothing. It's nothing. It has no weight. However, evidence that would show that in this specific area, this is how these brothers acted, has great weight. And I think that what happened was, it's the confusion I think that many trial lawyers have, and possibly trial judges, with regard to what is character evidence, as opposed to what is evidence that will show the circumstances surrounding the event. And I can only come back to the numerous cases that this court has had. One of the commentators said that 404B, or in our case 0452, is one of the most litigated areas in criminal law. Why? Because it's the prosecutor's darling. This is what prosecutors use all the time to get in evidence that someone acted in a certain way or that they intended to do something, is they put in prior specific And subsequent. There's no contention here that you can't use subsequent acts to show the same thing, which is let me tell you about the instances of conduct which will help you to understand what happened here. I think the two cases which are most critical here and most illustrative are the New Mexico case and the Arizona case, which we cite, Maples and Fish. Go to those. Because that's exactly what happened in those two cases. In Maples, in the New Mexico case, let me just go quickly through Maples and Fish. In Maples and New Mexico case, the specific instance of conduct they wanted to bring in was this guy, when he gets high on meth, engages in fighting. Trial court said, no, you can't use specific instances. You can only use general reputation. Appellate court said, uh-uh, that's not what we're talking about. And that's exactly what happened here. Fish, the same thing. A hiker, a dog, if you threaten his dog, he acts in a certain way. Trial court said, no, you can't use specific instances of conduct. Appellate court said, no, trial court, you're wrong, because it was offered on another theory. The problem here is it all got cut off. The investigation got cut off. Everything got cut off with the pretrial order, which says you cannot offer specific instances of conduct on any theory. That's the specific language out of the order. And I'll reserve the remainder of my time.
Counsel, as you begin, I'm going to need to know on what basis you believe the granting of the motion in limine was correct, in as much as it precluded, from what I can tell, it precluded the defendant from arguing self-defense, in as much as he may have been able to show that he was not the initial aggressor.
Well, I'm going to answer that with this observation. The assertion of the defendant that there was evidence available that the Klan with Speedias went around, in essence, instigating fights, has no evidential basis in this case. And by that I mean the proponent of uncharged misconduct is responsible for demonstrating to the court, before they're going to offer it, by clear and convincing evidence, the taint factors, that such evidence exists. Twice in the pretrial hearing on this issue, in response to the motion in limine filed by the state, the defendant's counsel acknowledged that he did not have any evidence of uncharged misconduct on the part of the Espedias, and that he agreed that because of that, he was limited to the proffer of reputation and opinion testimony, which, in fact, was offered. I think the court's preclusion of that evidence was based on the defendant's counsel's declaration to the court that the evidence didn't exist, or at least he didn't have it. And, you know, it's pure speculation that the government somehow knew that there was something out there. The fact of the matter is the motion in limine was filed to ensure that everybody understood what the rules were with respect to this issue. So he wasn't deprived of presenting a defense of self-defense. What he was prevented from doing was offering, in essence, this bald assertion that somehow the Espedias went around instigating fights, and there was absolutely no evidence of it that was proffered to the court in advance of trial in order to make a reasoned decision about whether or not, regardless of the theory that you might ascribe the admissibility to, should be that a jury should hear it. That's what happened, Your Honor. And if you look at the reply brief, when the government argues that this was not preserved, the best that they can do is suggest it was preserved by a statement by Matthew Locuson, a local law enforcement officer who had known Eric for a long time, that there was fights at the cantina on Saturday night, and Eric Espedia was there in some form or another. We're not talking about evidence that Mr. Eric Espedia had engaged in prior acts of misconduct relative to fighting. That isn't what they cite in the brief.
They do continue. The exact site is there's usually trouble at La Cantina every Saturday night. Often it does involve a fight in brackets. Usually Eric Espedia is involved in some way or another. And then it goes on to say there's testimony that the Espedia men go around the community fist fighting all the time.
Well, I'd like to know what that testimony was.
Okay. So you dispute that you say the record doesn't contain that second statement.
There isn't any. Okay. And in fact, he conceded that there wasn't any. In the motion in limine. He conceded it twice. You know, when they filed their motion for reconsideration concerning Salvador Espedia, if you look at that, what he was offering to prove is that Salvador Espedia and a different brother were stabbed trying to subdue a person who had placed a knife against the bartender's neck after these events. That was one of the things that he offered to prove in the motion for reconsideration. And the next thing that he wanted to prove was that Salvador Espedia was involved in a fight where the other individual hit him in the head with a beer bottle and was arrested for it. Not Salvador Espedia, the other individual was arrested for it. I defy anybody to look at that record and point to something that indicates that the defendant was in possession of any evidence which would meet the Tenth Standard that Eric Espedia or the Espedias had engaged in prior this bald assertion that they went around fighting. And that's a heck of a departure from the rules that have been traditionally applied to this as this court announced them in Daniel. And you know there's a reason for it. If you look at the Adjutant case, where the Massachusetts Supreme Court in essence adopted the theory that the defendant is now proposing to this court, that it's admissible for another purpose. 7 years later, they decided a case called Commonwealth versus Morales, where they were in essence, by circumstance or otherwise, came to the conclusion that if the defendant was going to, the defendant was going to offer proof of uncharged misconduct, specific evidence, specific instances of misconduct by the decedent in a homicide case, the state could do it too against the defendant. Which is exactly the problem that Foster warns about. So these trials will all devolve into who can dig up the most dirt on the defendant and the decedent. That's exactly why this evidence is precluded. Exactly.
Can you comment on the Mexico and the Arizona cases where a court of appeals would seem to either recharacterize what you're talking about or direct the trial court, at least in those two jurisdictions?
What they've done is they've accepted this proposition that it's really admissible, not as character evidence, but as evidence, other evidence relevant to the issue of aggression. Who was the
my original question.
Right. And I guess my response to that is, this is not, you know, traditionally, and in Daniels, this evidence is not admissible. You can put all the evidence you want to about the decedent in the form of reputation and opinion. You can't put specific instances of misconduct on unless the defendant knew about it. And so this is a departure, in essence, from that restriction. On this sleight of hand, I say it is, well, we're now going to let it in on the issue for another purpose, and that is the issue of whether or not who was the first aggressor. And my problem with that is you can shorn of all of that theory, it is propensity evidence. And in fact, the Massachusetts Supreme Court, in this quote I excerpted in my brief, starts out acknowledging that it is propensity evidence. But we're going to let it in anyway. We're going to let it in anyway for this other purpose. And I'm suggesting to you that the danger in that is demonstrated by what happened in the subsequent case in Massachusetts, where the government now is going to be able to respond by pointing out the bad things the defendant did. Now, I'm not suggesting we had any such evidence in this case. I'm talking about the danger of it and why it was traditionally limited. Can you imagine, and as you sit there and think about it, that there's any way in a criminal trial for homicide where the issue of self-defense, that if the government is allowed to present evidence and rebuttal of misconduct by the defendants in response to this theory of admissibility, that you're somehow going to instruct a jury to really not consider it as propensity evidence? And that's why it's been precluded, I suggest to you, as a matter of legal policy. I guess what I'm saying is one, there's no factual basis in this case for you to make a reasoned decision, and neither could the trial court, about whether or not such evidence existed to even consider the theory they're now proffering, which I'm suggesting to you, other than the bald assertion that the Espedia brothers go around starting fights, was never demonstrated in the record in any way, shape, or form.
Well, there were actually references to newspaper articles and preliminary hearing testimony that was part of the record.
Well, but what was cited in the briefs, and all I'm aware of, is this assertion by Matt Locuson that there was trouble on Saturday nights at the cantina and Eric Espedia was usually involved in some form.
He also testified, because Mr. Locuson is a police officer, according to the record, he testified that he had arrested Eric for fighting.
Right. But if you read Daniel, arrest is completely and utterly irrelevant, and it is not a form of character.
Daniel says arrest alone is not enough.
Right. It's the underlying facts. The arrest itself, in and of itself, is not evidence, because all it represents is a police officer's determination that he thinks the crime has been committed. The arrest itself is not admissible, and Daniel made that clear. It's the underlying facts, if it's admissible. I'll answer any other questions you have about that theory, but my point is, you can't look at this record and say what it is they were going to offer. One. And two, it's a bad idea. I want to talk a little bit about the sufficiency of the evidence. We all know what the standard is, but it seems to me that not the briefs in this case, and particularly by the defendant, do not tell the whole story in terms of what evidence was available to the jury relative to who did what. And relative to the commencement of the hostilities on the night in question, you know, Angela Evans, they try to make light of the fact that Angela Evans was a centerpiece, but the fact of the matter is that Esther Espedia testified that they heard this remark. The one she heard was, why don't you, in essence, the substance of which was, why don't you go back where you came from, which caused them to come around the end of her van where they were trying to get Eric into, and they saw a man coming down the corridor at them, and Eric responded. This man had a black headband on, which was found in the middle of the corridor several yards from the back of the tractor. Not only that, but Angela Evans testified that just immediately prior to the fight, Patrick Dunn was standing in the open well of the door, the driver's door, and he suddenly departed, going back towards the end of the tractor, which would put him in the direction of the SPDs if you look at the charts. And the next thing that happens is she looks out the rear and sees this fight in progress. By the way, that black headband was identified as Mr. Dunn's, or very substantially similar to the one Dunn had on his head when he left the trap of the first one. gone towards the Espedias. The other thing was this thing with Kit Kat Kramer. You know, she wants to emphasize the fact that Sal Espedia told him he was going to kill him. If you read, it was done on the impeachment by a prior inconsistent statements. If you read Kramer's testimony, what he says is, yeah, he was pinned against the car, but he had this man tangled up. He never got struck. Yes, he did threaten him. But immediately prior to hearing the shot, they had had a conversation wherein they had agreed that this should end. Salvador Espedia lets him up, and they hear this shot, in response to which Chance Kramer exclaims, no, and sees the tractor going off down the corridor towards Commercial Street, where it departed. There seems to be a thrust or a theory to the defendant's brief that somehow the jury was not entitled to believe this Espedia. And if you believe Esther, her brother would stand still at the end of the car when Mr. Dunn went to the car, got the gun, walked down the tractor to the back of the car, and shot him. State's position is that there was clearly, and the trial court found in the motion for new trial filed immediately after trial, in its review of the evidence, there was clearly evidence to support the jury's verdict, and the defendant, I would suggest to the court respectfully, has given you no reason to dispute that. And you know what, as I think back about it, I don't know that I recited my name when I started. So I'll do it backwards, if I can. My first name is Mark Corvinan from the District Attorney's Office in Elko, Nevada, and I appeared on behalf of the state.
Thank you so much, sir. Ms. Forsman, you have just over 4 minutes.
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honor. The jury was entitled to believe the Espedias, but the jury was also entitled to know the whole story. The jury was entitled to know that Sal Espedia, rather than being portrayed as the peacemaker that the state portrayed him as, was actually someone who became frequently involved in fights in exactly that place. At Appendix 1, this is really important to know, at Appendix 143, Mr. Olson, the trial attorney, talks about this is why this was premature, and that's why sometimes, I mean, a motion in limine is not like a motion to suppress. A motion in limine is simply, as I tell my students, an early objection. And one of the reasons for that is that one of the reasons they are often not entertained, but rather done during trial, is because as the evidence develops. What Mr. Olson says is Appendix 143 is we have a plenitude of evidence that we're trying to find, but people are afraid to come in. This is a little town. The officer, Lucuson, testified in the preliminary hearing that he had arrested Eric Espedia 15 times, that he knew him over the years. It wasn't developed because he was never put on the stand for that purpose. He was in the preliminary hearing as to what those 15 times were, how many of those times were at the cantina. Clearly, the state knew something, because they filed the motion in limine. I think that it's important to recognize that there is a difference.
What was the exact proffer that was, what was the evidence that was offered that was excluded by the district court as a result of the ruling on the motion in limine?
The evidence was that Eric and Sal Espedia had engaged in fights when they were drunk at the cantina and the Tiki Hut or in that area in Elko.
Okay, and what record sites support that proffer?
Well, here's the problem, is that there's a difference between an offer of proof and a preservation of error.
Sure.
The defense does not need to come in and put up the witnesses that it has. It does need a specification of what evidence it is that it sought to introduce, which particularly in the motion to reconsider that Mr. Olson filed, okay, where he had the two specific events with Sal Espedia that he could get. He was still working on witnesses, clearly you can tell from his language, at the time of the hearing on the motion in limine. They were still trying to get witnesses to come in.
So the greater specificity would direct me to the motion for reconsideration.
In the motion for reconsideration, there are two articles. Mr. Torvinen did describe them. Okay, now they say that Sal Espedia, I mean, the characterization in the newspaper article may or may not be accurate, that there were enough factual basis to be able to say there were two violent confrontations after the shooting involving Salas Vizia. Now, if witnesses were called on that, would they say the same thing as the newspaper article? I don't know. But there really is nothing that requires you on a motion in limine other than saying, I mean, the offer of proof, the purposes were fulfilled. Did the judge know what the kind of evidence was that Mr. Olson sought to introduce? Now, if he couldn't do it at trial, he couldn't do it. Or if the facts came out, as Mr. Torvino said about these two violent fights at the cantina app that occurred after the shooting, if the facts come out and they're different, then the jury heard the difference. But the point is that the jury was entitled to hear it. The jury was entitled to hear the whole story.
Wasn't the jury advised at some point, wasn't Patrick allowed to ask about specific instances of misconduct by Eric and Sal on cross-examination?
No.
How was that limited?
Okay, no. He was allowed to cross-examine if someone put forth Eric and Sal's good reputation. Okay. And of course, they didn't have that kind of evidence because they didn't have a good reputation. But had they had a good reputation, the court said, yes, you can cross-examine. As that particular rule permits cross-examine on specific instances of conduct if they were to put in either the victim's
but
good reputation
that
or
that didn't brothers. Happen. The district court didn't allow him to make that inquiry, the defendant.
No, because the predicate for that was that the state would have offered good reputation for nonviolence on the part of the victim and Salas Vizia.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you,
Your Honor. And oral argument. We appreciate them very much. The case will be submitted and we'll stand in recess.